Welcome to The Rundown. I'm your host, Justin Pugliese. This podcast is dedicated to you, the run community. Each episode, we bring you interviews with top athletes and community leaders. They'll share their stories, tips, and tricks to inspire and motivate you to keep running. Ultimately, we're all just here to have fun. From elite runners to weekend warriors, find out how people get started and why they keep going. So listen up, tell your run buddies, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on Apple Music, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
And hopefully my body feels good. I mean, hopefully I get out there and don't just feel wrecked. Because that can happen. I mean, I built up... This block was probably the biggest block I've ever had building up to this. And you're you know, it's not playing with fire. It's like pyrotechnics. Like, you know, you do know what you're doing, but it's like you can still burn yourself, you know? And this buildup in terms of volume is the highest I've ever had.
On this episode of The Rundown, I was lucky to have a great talk in Boston with professional endurance athlete Tommy Rivers Pusey. From early childhood through high school and into university, running remained a constant in his life. In fact, once he started, he never really stopped. Years of hard work and determination brought him to where he is today. He's a student of the sport and continuously pushes himself to unlock his true potential. With the U.S. trials in his sights, he'll lean on the unconditional love and support of his family to make that dream become a reality. Are you already subscribed to The Rundown, running with WRG, and still can't get enough? Sign up to their weekly newsletter and always stay connected. You can learn more about what's happening in the community, hear about exclusive run events, and stay up to date with the podcast. Just go to iamarunner.ca and subscribe. Simple as that. You'll never miss a beat. In this week's news, a few weeks ago at the Boston Marathon, a 28-year-old mechanical engineer from Colorado Springs lined up for the race in Wave 1 with all the other runners, taking off 2 minutes behind the elites. But when the gun went off, Steven Van Gempler left all the citizen runners in his dust, running negative splits on his way to a massive PR of 2 hours, 18 minutes, and 40 seconds, finishing with the 26th fastest time and passing half of the elite field. Not only was he the top amateur in the race, but he also qualified for the 2020 U.S. Olympic trials in the process. Not bad for a guy who's self-coached and does most of his runs solo because of a hectic work schedule. It'll be interesting to see how he does at the Olympic trials next February in Atlanta. I'd also like to remind you about the Wings for Life World Run, happening this Sunday, May 5th at 7 a.m. A global race where 100% of your registration fee goes towards spinal cord research studies. Join me and thousands of runners around the world for this unique event. To find out more about Wings for Life and their Montreal ambassador, Ben LeClaire, check out episode 16 of The Rundown. His goal is to complete 5 kilometers in a hand cycle, and we'll definitely be there to cheer him on. Make sure to check the show notes for links and more information. That's all for now. Gotta run. I haven't had too many male elite runners on the show, but you'll be pressed to meet a more honest and humble professional runner than my next guest, Tommy Pusey.
Hey, man.
Welcome to The Rundown.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Did I get the last name right?
Oh, dude, we just don't even go there. It's just, it's a tough one. Pusey.
Yeah, Pusey,
that's okay. Typically how they pronounced it 200 years ago when we came over from England, so.
You prefer Ribs? Is that?
Oh, so my middle name is Rivers. My parents were kind of desert rats and hippies, and so my dad named me Rivers, and Rivers is just kind of a nickname from that, so.
Amazing.
Anyway, there's a lot of Thomases and a lot of Tommies and not a lot of Rivers, but it's kind of a weird name. So Rivers is just kind of what's evolved out of it. But
as you go kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is kind of like an exclusive podcast interview that I really wasn't expecting. So it's like a pleasure to have you on the show, and we're able to record it live in Boston, which again, it's kind of a special weekend. Typically, I don't date these things, but because we're here and it's a world major, it's always special.
Yeah, for sure, man. Yeah, I'm stoked to do it, and there's not really a better weekend in all the world, geographically or chronologically than Boston Marathon Monday. It's a pretty epic event, so I'm stoked to be here and stoked to do this.
Exactly. Where did it all start for you? Like, were you active as a kid? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, man. So, yeah, honestly, people ask me, I guess all the time, they say, you know, when did you start running? And I think the easiest answer is that I just never stopped running, if that makes sense. As kids, little kids are constantly active. They're constantly, as soon as they learn how to walk or as soon as they learn how to run, it's almost like the transition isn't even there. It's like you crawl and then you run. There's not really much of a walking phase. And then, you know, after kids are two or three and they're starting to get into trouble, everybody's just constantly telling them for the next decade, like, don't run, don't run, don't run. You can't run, you know? And they say that at school and they say that at church and they say that at the pool and they say that, you know, everywhere you go. And so eventually kids learn to obey and they stop. And then, you know, they reap the consequences of a sedentary lifestyle after a couple of years. And then everybody tries to motivate them to run again, you know? And after the second or third or fourth decade of people's lives, they come to this realization that, oh man, like this has had negative consequences. And, I grew up in the arid rural Southwest United States. So I was born in Eastern New Mexico, right on the border with West Texas. And then, lived there for about a decade. And then I lived in Eastern Oregon, and it was geographically different, but culturally the exact same, just farmers and cowboys. And, yeah, and we lived a very outdoor lifestyle. We didn't have, I mean, in terms of like, you know, technology and stuff like that, it was a very simple lifestyle. It was, you know, we spent time outside just exploring, and I'm one of four boys, and so we constantly were getting into trouble. And yeah, we were sent outside all the time. It was constantly, you know, one of these like, you know, go outside until it's dark and then come home. And there wasn't much regulation on that. So yeah, we were just wild kids, and the mode of transportation was on foot or bikes, you know, and just always getting into trouble and, you know, sneaking into people's yards and getting chased by cops. And, I mean, stuff like that, you know, just stuff that, just the kind of good trouble that country kids get into. You know?
Yeah. And yeah. Did it evolve into something more for you, or is it always just like just a fun way of being active?
Man, I haven't even thought about this for a long time. I think that, how did that happen? You know what it was? My older brother, he actually lives in Canmore. He got into running when he was in junior high, or middle school, seventh or eighth grade. And I played soccer as a kid. And so, yeah, there wasn't a huge value put on sports, like in my home. It was just kind of like, that's what you do and that's fun. And, you know, we weren't allowed to play football and we weren't allowed to play baseball. And it wasn't because, you know, my folks were afraid we were going to get injured. It was because there were a lot of us kids and my mom didn't want to go to games that lasted that long, you know, with all the kids. And so something like soccer, it was like, okay, that's an hour, or something like, you know, a race, a cross country race or a track race. It's like, okay, that's a quick race and then you're done. And so, he got into that in seventh or eighth grade, and he had a coach. His name was Timo. He's from Mexico. And, we lived in this rural community. And he allowed me to come to these meets and run in these cross-country meets. And I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, it was like, I remember the first time my brother said, hey, we're going to go running. And he invited me to come, and I was so stoked. He was I think 2 or 3 years older than me. And, you know, he's like, hey, get ready. We're going to go run, you know, in 15 minutes. And I was like, sweet. And so I got all dressed, and I came downstairs, and I was wearing my soccer cleats because I was like, well, what else am I going to run in, you know? And he looked at me and he was like, we're going to go run on the road. Like, you're going to embarrass me in front of my friends, dude. Like, you can't wear soccer cleats. And I was like, well, what do you wear? You know? And so we ran, you know, we'd have these summer track meets, in the town that I lived in, and we'd go do those. And I remember I ran in like van slip-ons, like when I was a kid, and we were poor. I mean, we didn't have a ton. And my mom told me they had like, I remember they had planets on them and like comets and like, shooting stars, and she was like, those will make you run fast because they have shooting stars on them. And I was like, oh, for sure. And I totally believed it, you know.
Do you still believe it?
I think if you believe it, it has an effect, but I believed it at the time. And then running in those meets, like, the coach would let me run, and I wasn't technically supposed to. I was in fourth or fifth grade, you know, and they were, actually sanctioned meets, you know, that schools went to and stuff like that. And he let me borrow his pair of, spikes, his cross country spikes. And so I showed up, and I think by then I was in fifth grade, and it was mostly the kids were in seventh and eighth grade. And he let me run in this thing, and I think it was a mile and a half or so. And my brother, Jake, he said, I was like, hey, what do I do? And he goes, okay, just take it easy until you see the finish line. And then once you see the finish line, then you can start trying, you know, which was really simple advice. And so I was like, all right, sweet. And so we took off, and I caught him like right around, there was like a half mile left. I caught him, and then I caught like a couple of other guys, and they were the top guys on the team. And he turned, and, you know, I'm huffing and puffing, and I'm like, hey, Jake. And he turned, and he was just shocked to see me like right on his, you know, breathing down his back. and as the older brother, I think he was like proud, but also just kind of like, oh dang, like, no, you're not supposed to be this close, you know? And I said, hey, I can see the finish line. Is now a good time to start trying? and he looked at me like, what? And then I remember I tripped and I fell down or something. And I think I tripped over like my own feet, but I tripped. And then, just that, you know, a couple of meters distance. And I think that's not something we've ever actually talked about, that part, but I think that just kind of like made things easy, because there was no awkward, oh, do I try to run with him, or do I try to outkick him, or does he try to outkick me, or whatever, you know? And so we were spared that for a few years. And then I was kind of hooked after that. Like I was in Oregon at the time. And growing up in Oregon, you, at least rural Oregon, you become a football player or you become a rodeo cowboy. I mean, those are the sports. And I wasn't allowed to play football, and I didn't want to be a rodeo cowboy. And so it was like, okay, I guess I'll run, you know? And so I got into that largely because my brother had done it. Had he done anything else, I would have done that. You know, it was just what little brothers do. And we went that route. And then there's this culture in Oregon, specifically with the University of Oregon and the history back into the 70s with all the runners and Bill Bowerman, who eventually was the founder of Nike and coached at the University of Oregon, and Steve Prefontaine, this kid that grew up in Coos Bay, and he eventually competed for the U.S. in the 1972 Olympics in Munich, and then he died when he was 24, but everybody predicted that he would have won gold in Montreal in 76 in the 5,000 meters. But I grew up just like that guy was my idol, you know, and growing up in a small town, blue collar, you know, culture, just hardworking kids. It was really easy to have him be this hero, you know, to champion kind of your cause. And the reason was because he didn't have anything going for him. And it was like, he worked himself so hard, and his ability to endure pain and to endure just the trials of training, that became the mantra. And so that was something that it was like, okay, we're these poor kids that live in this cowboy town on the east side of the state. And we have to race against these kids. You know, you'd call them, I mean, you know, some people would call them cake eaters, you know, like the kids that grew up private schools, you know, every opportunity. Like, you hear the word privilege thrown around a lot, and typically the distinctions are between, you know, these very distinct socioeconomic classes, or between ethnicities or races or backgrounds or things like that. But we saw ourselves as underprivileged, you know. We were competing against the privileged kids on the west side of the state that went to the private schools and, you know, were backed by teams like Nike and that had $1 million track facilities and things like that. And we were a bunch of kids that lived in a farming community and kids of, you know, first generation migrant workers from Michoacan, Mexico, you know? And so it was just this tough work hard mentality. And so, I grew up with that and just these dreams he gave people the freedom, the right, the license to dream big, to kind of change your cards, you know, and based off of your ability to endure pain and your ability to endure tough training. And so that became the currency to privilege, you know. It was like, you can work your way out of this rather than just having to deal with the cards you're dealt. And so that fueled me. And I mean, that kind of stuff, like when I was a kid, you know, fifth grade, sixth grade, and I had posters on my wall, and like I knew all of the times and all of, you know, I had my future lined out, you know. In by ninth grade, I was going to run this fast, and 10th grade this fast. And by college, I wasn't going to go to college, because, you know, you don't go to college, you just go pro, you know? I mean, it was like the Olympics were coming up, and it was like, in my mind as a kid, it's like, okay, this is my trajectory to something great, you know? And obviously it doesn't work that way, but like...
Well, pretty good. Still pretty good.
Well, it's been a couple of decades since then. You know? But anyway, yeah. So that, I don't mean to get too tangential, but that's kind of how it went. It started out just basic kind of inspiration from, you know, this is what your older brother does, so this is what you're going to do. And then you get caught up in the culture of it. And then, you just this, that really, the chance to do something great, you know, that idea of potential that both motivates you and haunts you, you know, that it's like, okay, what can I become? What could I do? And, in a sport that hard work is just as important as talent. You know, it's out there if you want it, you just have to chase it. And so it becomes addictive for a kid, you know?
Of course. You're chasing the dream.
Right.
Essentially. And yeah. It's nice that you realize that like so early on. I think a lot of times we make changes throughout in what we love and we forget what we love sometimes and get away from it.
Right.
But it sounds like you've kind of followed that same passion. It's been a consistent for you.
Yeah. You had to, it became a two-edged sword though. You know, it became something that I realized really early on, okay, these are the ingredients for success. But what I didn't realize for a couple of decades was that moderation and consistency and temperance and balance and all of that is how you actually reach these really high heights. I didn't realize, it took me a long time to realize that if I go out and just put in all the work and train harder than everybody else, most likely the result will be an overuse injury rather than success, you know? And so that took me a long time to realize, how do you train smart? How do you avoid injury? How do you stay consistent? Because that's the thing, that the greatest potential deterrent from success in endurance athletics is not lack of motivation. It's actually the opposite. It's too much motivation over too short of a period of time. And so it's not burnout. It's the idea of thinking that you can take these shortcuts, thinking that you don't have to. You don't have to earn your fitness. And when I say that, it's not just, okay, put in the work and the fitness comes. It's like, yeah, but you have to spread that out over weeks and months and years. Your body, it's an incredible, incredible thing. It took me, you know, through all of undergrad, university, and then grad school and through a doctorate program to realize just that's also kind of what drove me to do all that, was trying to understand that process and these different processes that our bodies go through. And just this basic notion, it's like biomedical science 101, is Wolff's law, W-O-L-F-F. He was an anatomist in the 1800s, and he discovered, working on bones, he discovered that these cadavers, he discovered that the bones were designed in a way that specifically accommodated stresses from, you know, the people that that own those bones, if that makes sense. So he came out with this theory, which eventually became a law, that stated that our bodies, our systems and our structures, heart, lungs, blood, structures, bones, tendons, ligaments, you know, muscles, our body's systems and structures will make positive adaptations in responses to the stresses that we put on them. And so essentially what that means is if we put work on a tissue or if we put work on a process or you know, any type of structure, our body will make a positive adaptation in response to that. And so there are rules to that, though. You know, you can't just go out and just, you can't learn to bench press 400 pounds the first time you do it. You have to build it up. And that's a process of stressing and resting and stressing and resting those tissues and building up just a layer at a time, you know, like you're climbing a ladder or, you know, steps in a staircase, a little bit at a time. And that same principle applies to our bones and our tendons and our ligaments and everything and our, you know, all the different systems in our bodies. And learning that, you know, eventually, like, getting up to, like, you know, a doctorate degree level of that understanding, it took that long before I realized, like, oh, so that's how you do this. Like, that's how you train your body. That's how you avoid the injuries, you know? And hard work, all of that, yeah, that's incredibly important. But if you don't temper that, if you don't spread that out over a long enough period of time, all you're going to get is an injury, you know? Yeah, and it's embarrassing that it took, you know, 3 decades of my life to have that understanding, but finally, with that understanding and then also that motivation, that fire, you know, the kids on my team, the migrant workers, they used to say fuego en los huesos, you know, like fire in the bones, you know, that motivation, that fire, you know, like that's what fueled us. But it was like, okay, but you can't just go out and do it, you know, just overnight. You've got to put in the work over a long period of time. So, mm-hmm. so yeah, that whole process has been incredibly long, but incredibly satisfying process that I guess has brought me to this point.
I love what you said there. And I find it funny, like, people want to sprint through marathon training.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what's the final goal? It's a marathon.
Right. Totally.
Why would we rush that?
Yeah.
For such a long distance, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think, like, learning through others, like, I've kind of realized some of the same things you've been talking about, just like being patient and giving yourself an opportunity to adapt and
right.
to take on more mileage and to recover properly. And,
sure.
And you're not going to get, like, you might have a goal, a speed objective.
Yeah.
You want to get faster. Everyone wants to get faster.
Yeah.
But they don't want to take the time to do it.
Absolutely.
They just want it everything right now.
Yeah.
Know? And that's the challenge. Was there something that happened along the way that made you want to learn this more? Or
was I think, honestly, it was just I was beating my head against a wall. I mean, I went through this cycle of motivation, really hard training, really big goals, inevitable overuse injury, and this catastrophic fall where my whole life just fell apart. And then, you know, this period of just darkness. And I didn't realize for several years that, like, my emotional well-being was tied to my ability to move. And you don't realize that when you have it. You only realize it when things get really dark, when all of a sudden you're not able to move, you know? And you know, with very few exceptions, that's a universal law with humans in general, at not just, you know, not just their emotional well-being, but the just complete holistic wellness. It's incredible how deeply we're connected to the natural world and how quickly things start to deteriorate and go south when we lose that connection. And I guess going through that cycle and then also realizing, you know, a couple of things that were really, I guess, influential was, when I was a kid, we were hard. I mean, we trained we trained really hard. Our coach, he was old fashioned. He told us, he said, hey, you know, if we had a question about diet, he said, eat like you're poor, you know, eat like poor people eat, which is like, you know, you look at most of the world, it's like very simple. It's rice and beans, you know, it's just some kind of legume and some kind of carb and vegetables and fruit and not a lot of meat. And it was just, he was just like, eat like you're poor. And he said, if you want to run like a Kenyan, then live like a Kenyan, you know? So, I mean, he's got these kids that are 12 and 13 and 14 that are studying up, like checking books out of the library. Like, what is rural Kenyan life like, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I got rid of my bed, you know, took my bed out of my room. I slept on, I had a couch in there, but I slept on the floor in my closet. And, I took cold showers and it was not even bordering on obsession. It was over the top, you know, just obsessed with this lifestyle. I realized that, if I took multivitamins before I went running, it would make me sick. I mean, so sick that, like, you know, I was nauseous and it would almost make me throw up. And so my mentality was not like, oh, okay, well then don't take your multivitamins before you go run. It's like, okay, I got to take these every day before I go run because it will make me sick. And if I run every day sick, and if I don't take them on the day that I have to race, it's like, dude, that's an incredible advantage because like the race day will be like, oh, this is my easy day. Cause I got to do this without being sick for once, you know? And I did that. I mean, like for years, like that was it got so used to it to where I still wake up and I take my multivitamins just because it's my habit, you know? Yeah. And I know like 15 minutes later, it's like, oh, I'm going to feel that, you know, that hot flash. I'm going to feel like nauseous. Like I got to throw up, but I'm just so used to it at this point that it's just, but a lot of those other things, you know, like, those things that people do to callous themselves. I sleep in a bed now, you know, I take warm showers. My training is not over the top. And the reason is because there's a lot of people that think that, that you have to punish yourself, that like you have to callous yourself, that you have to go through this stuff like day after day after day. And if you do it for long enough, like your body will just be stronger. And what I've realized is like physiologically, yes, that happens. Like your body will make these positive adaptations, but emotionally what happens is, you don't get callous, you just get tired. And so if you're going to the well, if you're punishing yourself, if you're hurting yourself on a daily basis and it's not productive pain, then it's just a waste. It's just stupid. And so it's like, what happens is you end up like emptying your well before you actually need it. So on days like big days, like really hard efforts in training or really hard races, what you find is that when you go to the well's empty because you've been dumping it, you know, emptying it this entire time. And so in situations like put in the work as much as possible consistently, but if there's ever opportunities to do things in a way that is less emotionally exhausting, then that's the way to do it. If you wake up and it's 30 degrees outside, what's that? Like 0 degrees Celsius. Mm-hmm. And it's raining and you have to go do a tempo run. And the forecast for the next day is, you know, 20 degrees warmer and not raining. It's like, dude, just rest another day and do it the next day. Cause the emotional strain that's going to take place on that particular day, if you force it, is not going to be worth the physical benefit that you get from it. And so just things like that. I mean, realizing that you really do need to take your easy days easy. And sometimes between efforts, you need to have 3 or 4 or even 5 completely easy days between those big efforts. And if you don't, it's just diminishing returns. Your body can't make those positive adaptations in response because that proportion of stress and rest is not equal. And that's something that took me a long time to realize. It's like, no, I did a hard day and then I did an easy day, so I'm ready to go hard again. And it's like, no. Like sometimes it takes, you know, 3 or 4 days for your body to recover from these hard efforts. And then you're ready to go again. Your body has absorbed that work and you're able to go back and lay down another layer of fitness and strength and durability and everything. But learning to listen, you know, to my body, learning to not get so caught up in you know, these events, like everybody wants to run the Boston Marathon, everybody. But if you're 6 weeks out and you decide, hey, I'm going to go run Boston, and you decide that you're just going to squeeze fitness into some arbitrary time frame, it just doesn't happen. It's like you may be motivated emotionally and mentally by it, but you have to go based off of the timeline that it takes for your body to be ready for it. And so learning to race when I was ready to race, learn to listen to my body, rather than trying to squeeze fitness into some arbitrary time frame. Like that's something that's been huge in the last 6 or 7 years. And that's made a huge difference for me. You know, just reading, just experiences, just seeing things. There are a couple of things that have made like just, really, really impactful things that I've seen or things that I've read, studying this kind of thing. The Olympics in 2012 in London, Mo Farah and Galen Rupp, both of these guys were guys that were training in Oregon, you know, where I grew up. And Galen was a year younger than me, when we were in high school. And so there were races where it was like, okay, can anyone run with Galen? You know, he showed up and I mean, even in high school, he was just a freak. And our teams competed and, you know, we competed on an individual basis and, trying to run with him, you know, or trying to be the guy that finished second behind him. Like that became the goal at a lot of, you know, different races. And I read something that was really interesting about him and Mo leading up to 2012. And what it said was if people aren't familiar with this, they won gold and silver in the Olympics in London in 2012 in the 10,000 meters. And it was crazy because a homegrown white American kid had never run, you know, with the East Africans at that level. And it's this article I read talked about the training specifically, and it said that in the 3 years leading up to London, that the two of them had taken a combined 12 days of full recovery in 3 years. 12 days. So that's 6 days each in 3 years, which is 2 days of recovery, full recovery per year, which is just insane when you think about it. And it's not like, oh, they're so hard, they're so tough that they just, you know, they just train through it. It's that they were able to figure out a way to avoid injury so that they were able to string together 3 years of fitness. Uninterrupted fitness, unplanned breaks, you know, from things like injury, you know, things like that. And so they were able to go into this and they averaged between 80 and 90 miles a week, which is, what is that in Ks? 120, 130 Ks a week. Yeah. Which is not a lot. I mean, compared to the guys that they were racing against that were running 130, 140 miles a week, close to 200 kilometers a week. And they said that the way that they were able to do that is by just avoiding injury and training smart. And so that crew, that team has, you know, been under scrutiny because there've been, you know, allegations of foul play and stuff. And so people just completely throw that out and they're like, well, you know, they're all just crooked. They're all just, you know, they're all just, breaking the rules and unethical, but it's like, okay, but if we throw out, you know, independent of everything else, they've got some things figured out that other people can learn from. And, you know, the ability to maintain consistent training through lack of, you know, eliminating the risk of injury. I mean, that's huge. That, and just reading that article, I mean, just something like that stuck with me just so much. Like thinking about that, if they each took a day off per week, which a lot of people do, that's 52 days a year, which over 3 years, that's over 300 days of recovery combined between the two of them. And yet they took a total of 12 recovery days, you know, just seeing that. And maybe it's that I grew up, you know, trying to race Galen, or maybe it was that, you know, they were in Oregon or, you know, whatever it was, but that's something that really, really stuck with me. And so since I read that, you know, it's been 8 or 9 years since I read that. That's been something that I've tried to implement myself, and you know, and I've had some seasons where things have gone well, and yeah, and other times where I've had to recalibrate and realize I was doing too much or not enough. And
Are you coached or are you self-taught? Like, is this?
No, I self-coach. My older brother and I have we actually have a coaching business, so we coach other athletes, and you know, we've both coached everything from high school up through, we both were assistants in, university teams and stuff like that. And then just, you know, spending a lifetime just compiling just things that you learn from, you know, living in Flagstaff, especially where I live and train now, you have the opportunity to work and train with just incredible coaches from all over the world. And, you know, some of the guys that, I mean, literally people that have written the book, you know, just having had the opportunity to just pick these guys' brains, you know, and go on runs with them. And, guys like Greg McMillan, Matt Fitzgerald, Jack Daniels, Dr. Jack Daniels. I mean, all of these guys are guys that I've had the opportunity to interact with and pick their brains, you know, in Flagstaff. And whether it was doing research for Jack Daniels or you know, just running with some of these other coaches. And now, you know, in Flagstaff, there's a couple of other professional teams. Coach Mike Smith, he coaches the team at Northern Arizona University, and they just won, again, the men's cross country team won the NCAA Division I, championship, which is just huge. I mean, that's crazy. That's just crazy to go back to back. And, you know, and on a weekly basis, there's just a community team in Flagstaff. It's a community track workout on Tuesday nights, and Mike coaches that community workout, and it's, you know, 60 to 100 people that show up from ages 14 to 70, you know, and he coaches everybody, you know, in that track workout. And and then Coach Ben Rosario and Coach Ben Bruce, they both coach. Ben Rosario is the head coach, and then Ben Bruce is the assistant coach of Northern Arizona Elite, which is a professional running team sponsored by Hoka, with the design of putting, you know, athletes in the Olympics. And and I have a chance, you know, as often as I want to train with those guys and, you know, pick their brains. And and a lot of times I'll do workouts with the female elite athletes. And man, just trying to hang with those girls, just women, I should say, yeah, just making it to the end of a 25, you know, literally a 40K workout with these girls. It's like, if I can do that, I know I'm fit, you know, but most of the time I get dropped and there's nothing I can do about it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It happens, you know, and yeah, it keeps you humble. Like, it happened a couple of weeks ago to me. Like yeah, there was a couple of female elites in Montreal that
yeah,
I'm close with, and I went out and did a workout with them and
yeah,
came out firing. And
yeah,
I just kept going until I caught them, but
yeah,
you know, they stopped their workout.
Yeah.
And I kept running.
Yeah. I
but
run.
It's humbling, you know?
Yeah. I tried to do a workout 2 weeks ago with, Kellen Taylor, and you know, if anybody knows Kellen, she's literally the toughest human being I've ever met in my life. Just so tough. And you know, 2 mile warm up, 10 miles at 6:30 per mile pace. And then we were going to drop down to, you know, 10 miles at 5:40. And this is up high. This is 7,000 feet. I think it's right around 2,400 meters high. And that's tough. That's tough. Especially that I'm a bigger dude. That's hard for me to run that fast at elevation. And, you know, it's just typical. I hung for the first section and then hung on for as long as I could during the next section. And it was just like, I can't run that fast. Like I'm going to black out if I keep going, cause I'm not getting enough oxygen, you know? And,
yeah,
and, you know, and that happens with other female elites on the team that, you know, I'll try to do workouts with, and I just get crushed, you know, every time. And, but, you know, I show up and I just keep trying,
just gotta show
you know,
up.
And shrug it off and not let it affect my confidence. Cause I know I'm fit. I know I'm fit. I just, it's just, yeah, just the combination of the altitude conversion that they get, and then the altitude conversion that I get, is just radically different based off of our body composition. And so I just shrug it off and I'm like, all right, okay, that was good for what it was. And now I'm going to do my own thing, keep pressing forward, you know, chin up sort of thing.
How beneficial do you find, because I've never ran at altitude.
Yeah.
And I know like Mel was just out there in Flagstaff and my friend Ariane too.
Yeah.
The girls were out there training. Mel was out there for a month.
Yeah.
How beneficial is the altitude training? I hear it's
sure
great, but.
Yeah, it is a piece. It's just basic physiology. I guess the easiest way to understand it is to look at how people use, how people cheat. And the easiest way people cheat in cycling and running, is by taking a substance called EPO. EPO is, that's three separate letters that, it's so interesting that it's a hormone that your body produces naturally. Your kidneys produce it. And what it is, it's a medication that's given to, cancer patients or other patients that have, typically it's like some type of pathology to their blood. Their blood is compromised. And so, this medication exists to keep people alive, but cyclists and Nordic athletes and, skiing and runners, they realized really early on in the 70s and the 80s when this stuff was becoming more widespread that if they took that it gave them an advantage. And a lot of this came out of, in 1968, the Olympics were in Mexico City, and Mexico City is about the same elevation as Flagstaff. It's just over 7,000 feet in elevation. And a lot of the Australians, the Brits, the runners from New Zealand, the runners from the United States that had done so well through the 50s and the 60s just got crushed in 72 by the East Africans that were living and training in the Great Rift Valley, you know, in Kenya, and then in these high elevation places in Ethiopia. And this was kind of the first time. There had been other instances that the East Africans had shown on a world stage, but this was like absolute dominance, you know? And the takeaway was people realizing that the living and training at higher elevations has an effect on your blood. And fitness comes down to blood. I mean, it really comes down to that's the defining variable a lot of times. And so so when you're living and training at altitude, what happens is your body goes into an oxygen deprived state. You call it hypoxia. Hypo meaning deficient or below, and oxia meaning oxygen. So deficient oxygen. So your body then triggers a response. Your kidneys produce something called EPO, which is erythropoietin. And erythro is Greek. It means red. And poietin means poiesis. It's Greek for like the production of. So it's a hormone that your kidneys produce for the production of red blood cells. And so that hormone is then absorbed through your bones, and then your bone marrow in your bones produces more red blood cells, and then that's absorbed through your skeletal system into your bloodstream. And red blood cells are what transport oxygen. So as you breathe in, the greater density of red blood cells in your blood, the more oxygen carrying capacity your blood has to carry that oxygen to your muscles. And your muscles rely on sugar and water and oxygen to produce energy. And so if you're deficient in any of those, it can't produce energy. But if you have a greater abundance of oxygen, which is typically the limiting factor in endurance athletics, then you just gain more horsepower essentially. And so living and training in altitude gives you the same effect naturally that cyclists and swimmers and, you know, skiers and runners have used for the last two or three decades, you know, illegally and unethically to give themselves these advantages. So it's essentially, I like to think of it as doping the way that the universe intended, because it's hard. I mean, it's a hard lifestyle. Your body recovers slower because there's less oxygen. you never feel good. You're constantly deficient, you know, and, but then you come down to sea level and you can just fly. And it's like, and some of it is like, you know, some of it is like an emotional thing. You realize like, wow, I feel really good down here. So you feel like you have, you know, like superpowers, but, and a lot of that is probably just because you felt so crappy in all the months leading up to it. But so if that's a limiting factor, if that's a limiting factor for somebody, then yes, it absolutely makes differences. You have to be careful in the way that you do it. You can really easily run yourself into a hole. If you don't, you have to train different at altitude when you know, compared to the way you run down at sea level. But if you know how to do that, then yeah, it can make huge, huge differences.
You have to try it sometime.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an addictive drug. 'Cause it really does. Yeah. It gives you the ability to really push and yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, that's why I live there. That's, you know, I live there. We've lived there for 5 years and we moved there from Hawaii, and Hawaii was incredible, you know, yeah. But there's too much oxygen down there. So
we is
yeah, wife. Yeah. Yeah. Me and my wife, Steph, and our three little girls. Yeah. Yeah.
And the funny thing is we spoke about it, but I went to school with Steph, like in elementary school in Montreal and in high school, which is crazy.
Man. You got to tell me what she was like back then. You got any dirt on her? Any stories?
Her mom actually was one of the tech teachers, I think, in computer class or something. Wow. Grade six, I remember.
Wow.
Like, yeah, it was nuts.
That's
like,
fun.
Yeah. So, but it must be fun for you guys to live out there, and the kids must have a great time too.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different lifestyle, but we like it. Yeah.
How do you do all this training with a family and?
Oh man, kids? People ask me that all the time. They're like, "How do you balance everything?" I mean, especially when I was in grad school, it was like I would commute, run to school, which was like, you know, almost 20K away, and then go to school all day and then commute home. And people were like, how do you run? And how do you, you know, have a job? And, you know, I had like online businesses and stuff like that and training full time. And, you know, how do you go to school and how do you have a family and how do you have, you know, time for like a relationship and like, how do you balance all of that? And my response was like, I don't, you know, Steph does, like Steph does all of it, you yeah, know? And, yeah. And, you know, I run and I go to school and I work and I come home and I try to have, you know, time with each of the girls and then, you know, time with Steph. And, but yeah, I mean that, no, like I couldn't do it without her. I don't mean, I know that sounds super cliche, but I mean, I literally couldn't, like it wouldn't be possible. And so, yeah, she's sacrificed a lot and she's, we've, you know, it's taken a really long time, but I mean, she even wrote like for several years, she had this blog series that she wrote, Chronicles of an Endurance Athlete's Wife, where she talked about, you know, that life as, I mean, that's something that you can't prepare somebody for if they don't know what that life entails, you know, and, you know, she grew up swimming and her family is all just incredible athletes and incredibly gifted in so many ways, but endurance athletics, that was something new, you know? And so that was one of those things that I don't know if she really knew what she was getting herself into, you know, but we've figured things out, you know, over, it's taken, a decade or so, but we figured stuff out and,
that's it.
I don't mean that in any finality because it's like, you're constantly like evolving, constantly figuring things out. But, yeah, we've gotten to the point where, you know, we've got a lot of really supportive family. And so her and I are able to go together sometimes on these, you know, whatever the adventure is or whatever. And that's really fun. That's really cool. After a long time, you know, the kids are finally old enough that we can get away for a couple of weeks at a time. And, mm-hmm. and that's really fun, but
definitely it sounds challenging. Was that the biggest challenge you faced in your running career?
Oh man. No, and, honestly.
And how do you overcome like, adversity and some challenges you faced along the way?
Yeah, for me, I mean, maybe that's been the biggest challenge for Steph in my running, in my running career, but, no, honestly, for me, like that was like the first time there was any like notion of or sense of normalcy in my life, you know, that created balance, that created perspective and realizing that, no, this is not the biggest, most important thing in the world, because it's not, you know, and so if anything, like, you know, the challenges have been the training and the moderation and, you know, learning how to string this thing together over a long period of time and learning to listen to my body and everything. And then obviously like just the daily discomfort of training. But no, that's been the easiest part, you know, that's been the part that's made it, that's made everything else. It's given meaning to it. You know, it's like, there's a reason that I'm beating my head against a wall now, instead of before it was just like a hobby, you know, but now it's like, no, this is like the means of earning a living, you know? And so like there's a reason behind it. And, our littlest one, her name's Poppy Joe. I shaved my beard off a while ago and I've had a big beard her entire life. And so
it's like your claim to fame pretty much.
Jeez. I mean, everybody's got to be reduced to something because it could be worse, but, yeah.
Beard in 2016, at the Boston Marathon was something else.
I'd love to be more than a beard at some point in my life. But, and honestly, that's why I chopped it off, because people were starting to like it too much. But,
I thought it was for arrow purposes. But.
Yeah, that, probably that too. But no, I'm trying really hard to be like an athlete, you know? And so like when you get reduced to that, it kind of like, it's like, oh man, really? Like that's what I get attention for, is the thing that requires absolutely no effort, you know? And so it's like, so I chopped it off and she, I came home and it was a week before she like believed that it was me, you know? And so I'd come home and I'd be like, hey Poppy. And she'd look at me and she kind of mad dog me a little bit, like just kind of like look down her nose at me like, who are you? And after a couple of days, she'd like, you know, she'd cuddle up to me and like, it was like, oh, there's this new friend that keeps showing up and like wants to, you know, wants to be my friend, you know? And eventually, you know, she'd like hug me and like, you know, she'd sit on my lap and I'd read her books and stuff and typical stuff. But like for the first couple of days, I was like, hey. And she'd look at me and she's like, who are you? And I was like, I'm your daddy. And she goes, no. She goes, my daddy's out running. And I was like, oh, no, I'm your daddy. And she was like, no. And I was like, who do you think I am? She'd say, oh, you're my daddy's friend. I was like, no, I'm daddy. And she'd be like, no, I don't believe it. And eventually, you know, after a couple of days, she finally stopped saying, oh, my daddy's out running. And it made me realize that like in her little world, you know, the way she saw things was that when dad is absent, it's because he's out running, you know, like yeah. That's what he's doing. And, you know, and then my other girls, I'll be putting my shoes on and they're like, oh, you going to work? And, I'll be like, yeah. And I love that they see that as, you know, that's the means of making this all work rather than just this hobby that means I'm absent all the time, you know? Yeah. And so, yeah. So anyway, that was long winded, but yeah, it's the contrary. It's made things more balanced and given purpose to it.
When does it change from being a runner to being a professional? And
oh man,
and is there a difference in you, or is it like, do you feel it that it's different?
It's, you know, that's an interesting thing. Yeah, that's a tricky question, because it, there are very, very, very few, purely professional runners in the world. By that I mean they make a good, comfortable living just completely based off of running. And a lot of that has had to do with the transition that's taken place in like the digital age with social media and with, digital marketing. I mean, that's been huge. I mean, I had no idea in school. I went to college for 12 years, you know, and if I'd have known that like literally at the end of the day, it would come down to like, how good are you at social media? Like that will be your job. It's like, oh man, are you kidding me? Like that would have been, geez, that would have been nice to know in high school, you know, that like, It's like, oh, what you really need to learn how to do is write, and you need to learn how to be good at mixed media, you know? And yeah, you got to run. Like, that's the vehicle, but like, people don't get paid to run. They get paid to tell a story about running, you know? So that's what I do. I mean, that really is it. Like, when it comes down to it, like, that's what I do, is tell a story about running. And, you know, and everybody has a different perspective and different struggles and challenges and things like that. But like, the results, like, that really is like not much in the big picture. It's like, yeah, you got to show up and you got to send it, you know, you got to really like go. But like, what keeps everything together is the ability to communicate that with people. And so you can be injured. I broke my back, in August of 2017. So in April of 2017, I raced Boston, and that was arguably the best race I'd had up to that point in my life. And then just a few weeks later, or a few months later,
and that was at 16th place finish.
Yeah, 16th. And then a few months later, I broke my back. I fell off of a staircase and fractured my lower spine. And that took a really, really long time. It was almost a year that I wasn't able to run. And you know, people would think like, well, if you make a living as a runner, then how is it that, you know, you're able to continue to do that? And the thing is that, man, people like a comeback story as much as they like, you know, a story of triumph. And so it's like, well, this doesn't change. I'll just still keep telling my story, you know? And my story is that I broke my back, you know, and I'm going to, you know, work through this. And honestly, like, social media is like, it's not even a love-hate relationship. It's mostly a hate-hate relationship. Like, it's not, I don't love it, but it's an incredibly, it can be a very self-centered, narcissistic, you know, outlet. And so what I've tried to do is I've always kept a journal. I've always, you know, been encouraged by my folks to write and to read and to travel and to experience things and then learn how to articulate that and, you know, share that. And it's become like my own personal history, you know? And so I write stuff, you know, from time to time. People are mean on, you know, behind a screen and on a digital world. And so they'll say stuff that's like, you know, I'll pour my heart out and people will just like, you know, just kick it around. And it's like, you know, sometimes people will be like, oh, I didn't agree with what you wrote, or I didn't like what you wrote. And I'm like, I didn't write it for you, man. I wrote it for me. Like, yeah. I'm sorry you didn't like it. Well, no, I'm not sorry. You know, it's like, I didn't write it for you. Yeah. I wrote it for me. Like, this is how I work through, you know, just the struggles and stuff. This is how I make sense of life. This is how I, organize this, you know, this chaos, of life that, you know, everybody experiences.
Right.
You know, the struggles and the good times and the grind and the challenge and all of that. And, you know, being able to try to write that down just to organize it for myself and to maintain perspective. And it's like, oh, I'll put that out there because this is a great way of like creating a record for myself. And if people can, you know, gain anything from that, that's awesome. But if it all ended, I'd still do it. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter to me. Or, I mean, really, it's like, I've done that from the time I was a kid, like in a journal and, in different forms throughout my entire life. And so this is how I, just organize everything and keep track of it. And, you know, the other thing is that like, we really have, it's created immortality, if that makes sense. I know that might sound hyperbolic, but what I mean by that is like, that's something that will never cease to exist ever. And, man, looking back, if I could have like a record like that of like my parents' lives or my grandparents' lives or my great grandparents' lives, you know, and looking at the struggles that they went through. Like if I could document them, like living in dugouts out in the desert, you know, in the early 1800s and like having nothing to live off of, you know, and things like that. Like, yeah. Like I have the stories because they wrote journals, but it's like, man, if I could have seen it, if I could have like had like insight into their thoughts and seen photos of them and like seen what they were like when they were, you know, happy and sad and when they felt like having a good time and like their sense of humor and things like that, man, that would be incredible. Like that's immortality. I mean, that's like, that's something that like, you know, both motivates me and haunts me. You know, same as potential. It's like, okay, whatever I put out there is going to be out there. My kids are going to see this. My grandkids are going to see this. And it's like, how cool is that? But at the same time, it's like, okay, like you got to keep your shit together, dude. Cause like, because it's, there's a record now, you know, yeah. And everyone's going to see
there's
it.
There's a paper trail there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know? And so that's really cool.
Yeah. But I think it's great too. Cause it gives, you know, it gave us the opportunity to connect
sure.
as well. I got to read about you, some of the races that you've done.
Yeah.
I thought my first Boston was in 2016. You raced it. And I got to read your kind of reenactment of what occurred that day.
Sure.
And it, yeah, there's a storytelling component to it, but it's also, it gives us some insight into, you know, somebody at a level that we may aspire to be like, or maybe just to give us motivation to do something that we couldn't do before.
Sure.
So I think in that sense, it is nice because you can share those experiences with people and you can inspire people all over the world, essentially.
Right, yeah.
You know, and reading even your post about the Houston.
Right.
I mean, that was scary. I felt scared for you.
Yeah, it was a little scary.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That was in the end of January this year, so just a few months ago. The Houston Marathon. It's a really fast course, and a lot of really quick runners come from all over the world to run fast there. And so,
Jim, your friend Jim, ran
Jim was there. Jim Walmsley was running the half marathon and, you know, we both had the same goal to go and get the qualifier for the Olympic trials and he was going to run the half and my goal was to run the full. And, yeah. And you know, he did that. He ran the slowest possible Olympic qualifying time. which is still smoking fast, you know.
104?
Yeah, exactly. 104. Well,
they call it 64.
Yeah,
right?
64. Yeah, 64 for the half, and he ran 64.00. So, yeah, not a second to spare, which is great. But yeah, and my goal was to run, you know, a qualifying time for the Olympic trials for the marathon is 2:18, and and I'd done that before in 2017 before I hurt myself, but it was, the window for the trials hadn't opened yet. And so, so I still don't have a trials qualifier. I still need to do that. And hopefully that'll happen on Monday. If the wind's good, but, no, but really, I mean, that makes
it get some wind at the back.
Right. No,
for
man,
change,
if
that'd
I can
be
have
nice.
A tailwind instead of a headwind. And you know, honestly, like that makes a difference. Like it's one of those things that it's like, I think I've done everything right in my training. I think I'm fit. I think I'm ready. I'm, you know, lean and mean and like ready to do this thing. But it's like, there are things out of my control, like what the weather's going to be like. And that doesn't mean I can't go out and have a great day, but like that will affect time, you know? And so, and so I hope it's good. And, I mean, the deciding variable will not be my effort. The effort will be there, you know? And so if my body's ready, I think it is, then it'll be a good day. And if it's not, it's like, all right, whatever, you know? So go back to the lab and figure out what happened and dust off and get back in the saddle and just, you know, keep working towards the next one. But that's something I've learned too, that it's like you can't fight the science, you know? And so it's like, if you do everything right, that's a big if, your effort is not the control variable. Once you know that, okay, like when race day shows up, like if I have to run until I black out, I'll do that. I hope it doesn't come to that. But like the effort part, like I've got that down, you know? And so once you are no longer afraid of that, you know, you have a healthy respect for it. And it's not a fear of the unknown. It's like a fear of the absolute known, you know, it's like, this is going to hurt. and let's do it, you know? And
once you see the finish.
Right.
Let's go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Once you see the finish, then you start trying. No, it's a little different now, but yeah. So anyway, yeah. Yeah. Houston, went out hard and it was one of those things that the conditions were a little bit colder than I would like. And I'm a big dude. And so because I'm big, relatively compared to some of the other guys that I race against, if you have a high amount of muscle mass and a low amount of fat, you're not very good at thermal regulation. You can't warm up very good and you can't cool down very good. And so in hot conditions, you are the first guy to get hot, and in cool conditions, you're the first guy to get hypothermic. And so, and the reason is because you have a lot of surface area and your body is trying to cool you down or warm you up. And the way it does that is through peripheral blood flow and sweating. And so your body pushes blood out to the surface to warm you up or to cool you down. And when it's too cold, what happens is you start to get too cold. And right around mile, it was right around 30K that I started to feel really cold. And I knew that it was because I was dehydrated. And what was happening is that my blood volume had dropped because I was dehydrated. So, you know, typically if I have 6 liters of blood, I now had 5. And, you know, it's still it's more concentrated, but there's not enough volume to get blood out to your periphery and also get blood up to your brain. And so your brain is, it's like 3% of your body's mass, but it requires like 30% of your body's blood. And so, we're rolling along and, I felt really good until I didn't, you know, and I was with a crew. It ended up being the chase pack of the men's race, and we were running right around 504, 505, 506 maybe miles up to that point. We came through the half came through 13 miles and 67 high, and then came through the half in, what was it, 64 low. So, I'm sorry, 68 low. So it was 68.0 something. And that was the fastest I'd ever run a half marathon before, you know? And, no, it was 67 low. Yeah. We came through the 12 miles and 66 high. And then we came through the half marathon in 67 low. And I was like, wow, that was a new personal best for the half marathon, you know? And I just thought that as we ran past it, you know,
I
still have another half, you know, we're at the halfway point. And so, you know, I kept rolling and I was in a good pack and everything was good. And I just wasn't getting enough fluids down. And, so right around 30K or so, started to get really cold. And then stuff just kind of started to fall apart. So I kind of couldn't hear very well. And then, like everything kind of was like an echo chamber. And then I was like, oh damn, it's starting to go. And then I'm trying to muscle my way through it and trying to hang on to that pack. And then, and then my vision started to go and it kind of just became like a little bit of like a looking through like a tunnel, you know, tunnel vision. And, just this dark, this dark shadow that just kind of gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then you're looking out of a pinhole kind of thing. And, and I don't really know what happened after that. Like I kind of was in and out of consciousness, I guess. And that group, that whole pack, they ran, all of them ran between, 2:13 and 2:14. And I stumbled across the line at like 2:20, you know, those last 3 miles, I don't remember that last 5K or so. Then I woke up in the medic tent and, somebody sent me a video of the finish like a week later. And that was really weird to watch. Cause it was like, I didn't remember any of it. And so to see something, you know, a video portrayal of yourself when you're not, you know, lucid, you don't know what's actually going on, you know? And then I saw myself kind of collapse and they put me in a wheelchair and I was out. I mean, just completely out. Like my head is just like, my chin's on my chest and I'm just like, just completely out. And then I remember waking up in the medical tent and they're like grinding on my chest because That's how you wake somebody up, I guess. But, anyway, yeah. So it was great. I mean, it was great until it fell apart. It was probably one of the most powerful learning experiences in my running career. Because I went out and I would have loved to have gone through the half in 68 and a half, maybe.
So a bit slower.
Yeah. Yeah. But there wasn't a pack. There wasn't a group of guys. I didn't have a group to run with. And so that group was running considerably faster, but it was like, okay, do I run by myself and do my own thing? Or do I take a chance and see how long I can hang with these guys, you know? And I maybe if the way I fell apart would have been a little bit more gradual, it wouldn't have been that big of a deal. If I'd have gone from running, you know, right around 5:05s to maybe 6:05s, like I still would have gotten the trials qualifier, like by a lot. And, I mean, I still thought at mile 23, the last image I had, I saw the mile 23 marker and I was like, okay, I've got 5K to go. And I was like, oh, you're going to run 2:14. You're going to run 2:14. You know, I just kept saying that to myself and it was just like, come on, come on, come on. You know, like talking to myself and then, you know, I didn't, but it was like, it's tricky. And that's something that'll happen on Monday. I don't know what'll happen. I'll go out with that elite field and I'm not going to win that race. I'm not even going to finish top 10, you know, not a chance, not a chance. And it's like, and I know that, you know, I would love to, but I'm just being realistic. Like unless everybody just blows up, like, you know, falls apart and has an awful day, that's not going to happen, you know?
You think Yuki thought he would win?
No. But he could.
Incredible.
208. He went in with a 208. And he's run sub 220 80 times. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I've run sub 220, I don't know, 10 times, maybe 6 times. I mean, I don't even know. And my best time is 10 minutes slower than Yuki's best time, you know? And so it's like the conditions were perfect for Yuki, given his just grit, you know, he's just tough. He's just resilient. I mean, like if you watch that race, it's like he took the lead and then fell back like 10 different times, you know, yeah. And he just kept coming back. And then finally he broke everyone and, you know, pulled away. But like,
the commentary on that race is just priceless.
It's pretty rough. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. They sure put their feet in their mouths on that. Yeah. It was pretty comical, but what will happen though is I'll go out with that front pack and I'll probably, you know, be with that group for a couple of miles, depending on how fast they go out. Who knows? Sometimes they go out really fast. If they go out in 4:30, which happens sometimes, I'm not going to run that fast for the first mile. I want to run 5:10s to 5:12s, through the first half. And so if that puts me in that front pack for the first couple of miles, that's great. If it doesn't, I don't care really. It doesn't really matter. Hopefully what happens though is there's a chase pack that forms that's running, right around that time. Because what happens is I can either run, if I run with a pack and they're running a little bit faster than I'd like to, that's better than running by myself, trying to hit exactly the splits that I want. And the reason is because in terms of effort, it's the exact same. If we're running into a 20 mile an hour headwind and I've got, you know, 12 bodies in front of me, that's easier than just running by myself like a flag out in the wind, you know, trying to just be hell bent on hitting my splits, you know? Mm-hmm. And looking at the conditions and everything, you know, time may go out the window after 2 miles. It may be just like, this isn't going to happen today, dude. Just do what you can do, you know? Mm-hmm. Or the wind could shift and it's like, whoa, we're rolling, you know? And that's the thing. Like, I don't have any control over that. Like nobody has any control over that. And when you try to will things to change that you can't change, then you're just spinning your wheels. You're just wasting energy. And so it's like, get out there and, you know, fingers crossed we get good wind, fingers crossed, like there's a pack that I can run with, but if not, you know, I'll do what I can control and hopefully my body feels good. I mean, hopefully I get out there and don't just feel wrecked, because that can happen. I mean, I built up, this block was probably the biggest block I've ever had building up to this. And you're, you know, it's not playing with fire. It's like pyrotechnics. Like, you know, you do know what you're doing, but it's like, you can still burn yourself, you know? And this buildup in terms of volume is the highest I've ever, ever had. And so that could translate into a really great performance on Monday, or it could be, I could be flat, you know, and just completely not there. And it doesn't matter. I mean, it's like, I'll go out and I know what I can do in terms of effort. And as long as that's there, it's like, you know, just keep your head down and keep grinding. And man, it could be a 240 or it could be 212. I have no idea, you know, mm-hmm. but it's like, it'll be fun though. I mean, it's Boston, you know, it's just like, geez, like the energy out there, like the people, like, it's just, there's nothing like it anywhere in the world. It's like it's like this giant parade and you're the float, you know. It's like
that's just, a perfect,
do you know what I mean though?
I know,
it's,
I know,
just like, it's, yeah, insane, like everybody, the whole state, like the whole world is out here, they just come to watch you run. I mean, that's such a trivial thing, and yet everybody cares so much. And I mean, like, and that our geez, that our lives have become so predictable and comfortable that we have to fabricate these, like, these fake scenarios where we feel alive and in danger and stuff, you know? It's like, man, like, we gotta run for something because we can, you know? And it's like, if we don't, then it's like a mockery to the people that don't have that opportunity, you know? I mean, I used to get caught up in this moral dilemma. It's like, is what I'm doing ethical? Like, to go out and waste this amount of time and resources and something that's so trivial as like running fast. It's like, it's so trivial, but it's like, no, I have the opportunity to. And so if I don't, that's a mockery to the people that don't have the opportunity, you know? And, man, I mean, there's people all over the world that are literally, running for their lives, you know? And so it's like, is it unethical to run for something if I'm not running from something, you know? And it's like, it's something that, yeah, that I have struggled with. And like, the more I travel, the more it's like, I feel a responsibility to, you know, rather than like, oh, this is just something I'm going to go out and just do. I'm not just blowing off steam or like, you know, a hobby. It's like, no, this gives me a space and a voice and a, you know, an opportunity to hopefully, you know, fully take advantage of how great our lives are relatively, you know, compared to so many people's whose lives have not been what ours are, you know, even on the shittiest days, like it's so much better than like, the 99% of the current world and 99% of the world's history, you know? It's like, there is nothing that we shouldn't, you know? I mean, everybody at least is listening to this or going to listen to this. It's like, if you're listening to this, it's like, there's a lot of crappy stuff going on in your life. I know there is, you know? And when there's not big things, the little things become big things, you know? Mm. When you're not fleeing a war, when you're not, you know, struggling to keep your kids alive that are starving, you know, when you're not wondering where you're going to get your next meal, there's somehow this level of stress that we just always revert to. And, you know, stubbing your toe on your bed and losing your iPhone feels just as big in the moment, you know? And so being able to like, you know, remind yourself that like, no, things are good. Even on the best day, things are better than most people currently in the world and most people that have ever lived in the world. And so it's like, man, like we can't just sit around and be bums like because our life is so good, because like the curse is now the excess of everything that we have rather than, you know, the scarcity of it. It's like, use that to do something good and powerful and, you know, hopefully motivate people along the way and keep yourself motivated. But yeah, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, it's always a good day. And yeah, try to maintain that perspective out there that even if stuff just falls apart, it's still the Boston Marathon. We get to race the Boston Marathon. I mean, yeah, like,
it's a real it's a privilege.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
I mean, I've done it. This is my third year in a row now, and it's, you know, it's just, I feel so lucky. I feel as lucky as I did the first time.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just, it's just such a nice, awesome place to be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And just like, I don't take it for granted for 1 minute. Like,
totally. Yeah.
You know, we, you know, worked for it, earned it.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, like, if you're not going to have that day that, you know, that day that you think you're going to have, like, the least you can do is just like, enjoy it and
right.
and show your gratitude to
totally
to the course and the people that are here and,
absolutely yeah
you know,
like at the end of the day, worst case scenario, things go really bad, like our lives are good enough and we have excess of resources to the extent that we get to go out and have a shitty day at Boston and it's not going to affect our lives one bit.
No.
Like, do you know what I mean?
I know.
Like, that's such a privileged position that like you have the luxury of being able to go out and have a shitty day at the Boston Marathon and it's not going to make any difference in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And man, if it's not, if it's a good day, it's like, man, even better. But like, even worst case scenario, like that's still just like an incredible gift and an incredible position and opportunity, you know? And yeah, so it'll be a good day, you know, even if it's a shitty day.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. But is that the thing that pushes you now, like motivates you, inspires you now to keep going? Or is there something else inside that?
Oh man, I got asked about that a while ago and I wrote something out just as I was thinking about it. But it had to do with potential. It had to do with my own potential. Like the fear of, I think more than anything, what motivates me is like the fear of waste. Whether that's like, you know, we grew up where it was like, you know, don't waste your food, don't waste your opportunities, don't waste your education, don't waste your relationships, don't waste this experience, you know? And so that's something that was ingrained like heavily. Like, you know, we grew up in a pretty, pretty orthodox, like religious home. But the takeaway from all of that was like, the greatest sin is waste. Like, you don't waste. And if you do, well, then you're making a mockery of everybody that doesn't have, you know, what you have. You know, as I've gotten older and my beliefs and cosmology have evolved and things like that, that's still something that is like, that's still deeply ingrained in me, is that like the fear of waste is probably what motivates me, where it's like, don't waste this opportunity. Don't waste this experience, you know? There's this quote that, you know, used to haunt me that's it's in this book. It goes back to Steve Prefontaine. The book is called Pre. And I remember reading that as a kid and there's a line in there and it talks about, it describes Pre and he says, Pre was absolutely determined to wring everything out of what he so-called the gift, you know, and the gift was this life, this opportunity, you know, and he was determined to wring everything out of that, you know, like a towel. And I, you know, that's something that like, man, it makes me wonder if like things that we read, experiences that we have, if it actually can like, like gene expression, if it can actually like, you know, change your DNA, because it's like, it literally changed my being, you know, like that. It was something that like affected me so profoundly that it was like, I'm changed. Like my kids are going to know this. They're going to be born with this, like ingrained in them, you know?
That is going to work.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And just that notion of like this gift, you know, this opportunity, like don't, there's this famous quote by him that's overquoted, but it says like, he said, to give anything less than your best is to sacrifice the gift, you know? And so it's like, that's what it is. It's like this idea of potential. My 100%, you know, whatever my 100% is on the day, like I want to find that. And it's like my 100% is going to be minutes behind the 100% of the elite men that win and maybe behind some of the elite women, you know? But if I give 100%, like I didn't lose, you know? Like you only lose if you don't give your 100%, if you piss away your energy on stuff that you can't control, like, oh, I missed that water stop. All right. Well, that's my excuse. Or, oh, my ankle started to hurt, you know, like, well, that's my excuse. Or like, Oh, calories were wrong. It's like, man, don't try to find a reason to, you know, blame why it didn't go right. It's like, figure out ways to make it go right, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, man, that really is what it comes down to. It's like focusing on what you can control and like, and then going out there and getting it, you know, and doing it. And
be the storm, right?
Totally. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Don't get caught up in just this stuff that, I mean, everybody's going to have to run the same race on the same course with the same conditions, you know? It's like, man, like, seize that and, like, rise up, you know? It's awesome. It's just such an opportunity. And, man, at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, like, what can you do? Like, what can you become? How great can you be at this, you know? And that's the thing that, like, yeah, that motivates me, but it haunts me, too. It's like, man, don't sacrifice that gift, you know?
It's always that balance,
right? Yeah, 100%. But
what does running mean to you? I know it's a pretty broad question, but
oh man, it's just been a part of me for my whole life, you know. And I, not to get like trivial about it, but it really is like who we are as human beings. Like that's what we do, you know? Like if people were to like describe in one verb what an animal does, you know? It's like birds are birds because they fly, and fish are fish because they swim. And if they don't, then they cease to be that, you know? And it doesn't have to be running, but like we're like bipedal hominids. Like what we do is move on 2 feet, you know, with very, very few exceptions. Because of accidents or because of, very rare congenital type things. But like the large majority of human beings, like that's what we do. Like as trite as it sounds, is like we literally are born to, not necessarily born to run, but we're born to move on our 2 feet and walk and hike and run and, you know, whatever. And so it's like, it literally is like the essence of who we are as human beings. And it's like, if we don't, and people think, you know, we're Homo sapiens, like thinking man, conscious man. It's like, no, we're running man, you know, mm-hmm. Like that's what we do. And if we don't, then in my mind, it's like, then we cease to be human beings. Like that's what we do. And yeah, if we had to break down in just a single verb, like to reduce ourselves to what we do as human beings, that's it for me. And it sounds like, you know, if you're only thinking of it in sense of like, okay, you go out and run, that's all we do is we run. Like that's like, there's more productive things to do with your life. And I agree 100%, but there is something that like, that connects our physical and mental and emotional states with our ability to move on foot in nature. It creates this balance. It creates this grounding that like, that so much of the world is missing and so many of the emotional issues that exist, I feel could be remedied by that, by exposure to this wild, rugged outside spaces on foot, you know, out there in the snow and the rain and the sun and the wind and all of that, you know? And like some of the greatest minds, like throughout all history have talked about that. Like Henry David Thoreau, he says, methinks that the moment my legs begin to move, my thoughts begin to flow, you know? It's like he understands there's that connection that exists between bipedal locomotion and your ability to understand things and break things down and, see things through a different perspective and have that, production and secretion of hormones that increase our sense of well-being, you know? I mean, it's basic science. It's like dopamine and serotonin, and the easiest way to get those things flowing through your body is to go walk or run, you know?
Get some fresh air.
Yeah, totally.
Just,
you know,
enjoy it. Like today was beautiful.
It's simple. Yeah,
it was
yeah.
Nice,
incredible.
Nice to get out and run. And,
yeah.
I just want to give you a chance to kind of tell me a bit about the people that have supported you and helped you get to this stage. Is there any like sponsors or?
Oh geez. Yeah. Oh yeah. That
people,
kind of thing.
People behind you.
Yeah, man, that list is huge. It, first and foremost, like obviously Steph, you know, and my girls, Iris and Puppy and Harper, they, Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that motivates me too. That kind of idea of like, there has been too many people supporting you for too long to like piss away these opportunities. So it's like when things get dark out there, cause it will, it's going to get dark and really hard. And, there will be moments, not just one, but multiple times where it's like, you have to decide over and over and over to, make that choice that you're going to continue, you know, striving towards whatever those goals were before you start. And that motivates me, this idea of, well, this isn't about just you anymore. You know, this isn't about just, you know, the efforts that you put in. This has to do with like, okay, what experiences did you miss? And the nights that you're too tired to, you know, be with your family, you know, and you fall asleep at 8 o'clock when like, you know, Steph's there wanting to watch a movie, you know, and grouchy coming home from a run because I didn't eat enough things like that. Like there's so much that so many people, especially, you know, those four, have had to endure for so long that it's like, man, there's gotta be some balance. You gotta make this worth it. Cause it's like, if not, it's like, you did that for what, you know? And so, yeah, first and foremost them, obviously, you know, sponsors, I'm grateful for them, but at the end of the day, it comes down to my family more than anything.
Is your brother still the guy that you look up to? Like, you know, when kids?
Always. Yeah, of course. Yeah. So my older brother, Jake, yeah, he's the one in Canmore. He's somebody that like always, like I find that there are things that I do in my life, these idiosyncrasies that I have that it's like, why do I like basil? Why do I like ginger? Why do I like dark chocolate? Things like that, where I'm like, I think back on it and I'm like, wait, I don't, Jake does. And it's like, it's like, oh, you know, all these things that like I've wanted to do for so long because it's been like the desire to like have, you know, the nod from the older brother kind of thing, you know? And so always, you know, that's something that I don't think you ever grow out of that, but yeah, of course.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Tommy, I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah.
Like I said, this was kind of like up in the air a little bit, and I'm really happy it came to fruition, and the fact that we got to sit together and get some of your insight and feedback. I know you're somebody that I look up to, even though it's through social media. Like, that's the positive, and I know a lot of people do too, and I hope people learn something from this chat that we had today.
Yeah, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it, and yeah, it's so cool when people can come together and you've got abilities that I don't possess, that I won't ever possess, you know how to, and to create a voice. And so I appreciate that, man. It allows all of this to be articulated and communicated in another way, and I guess, you know, what I've realized is that's what it comes down to, is being able to have a story worth telling and then telling it, you know? So thank you for taking the time and for doing this, and I really appreciate it, man.
You're welcome, and I look forward to seeing how the story ends on Monday for both of us.
Yeah, me too, man.
So,
yeah.
So good luck.
Yeah. Let's send it. Yeah.
Give her.
Yeah.
We'll touch base after that.
All right, cool. Thanks,
man. Bye. Yeah. This episode is brought to you by the Outrun Retreat. The perfect combination of running, yoga, and wellness, all rolled into one weekend in the great outdoors. Join them May 30th to June 2nd at a beautiful cottage tucked away in the Eastern Townships. Elite runner Ariane Rabi and her team will guide you every step of the way, helping you set new goals and objectives for 2019. For more information, visit theoutrun.ca. See you out there. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Rundown. We hope you enjoyed our show. Please make sure to visit us at imarunner.ca. You can also let us know what you think and follow us on Instagram at The Rundown. Now take what you've learned and run with it. The Rundown is a production by WRG Media, recorded in the historic RCA building in downtown Montreal. Produced and recorded by Forrest McKay. Our executive producers, Leslie and Lindsay Woods. Graphics and illustrations created by Ryan Bondi with assistance by Mark Grimberg. Marketing by Joe Garcia, and hosted by me, Justin Pugliese.